Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna Moore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, as your host and my co-host, my able and willing co-host every Saturday evening, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Up Publicity, is with me here, or shall I say across the miles in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So welcome, everyone. Welcome. I hope you are comfortable and you are in an air-conditioned space because we are still sweltering here in the Northeast. But if you're in a comfortable place to listen to this radio show, all the better. And if, again, if you're not able to listen live and in person, let me remind you that this will be on the archives within 24 hours or so, and you can listen to your heart's content. We hope that you learn a lot and you pass them on to other people. And that is the beauty of the podcast and radio communication and social media and Imagine Publicity and everything. I just have to give my due to all of these forms of media, or else we could not be educating people and informing them. And Delilah, I just want to say good evening, and do you agree with the comments I just made? I just think it's so very important for us to have this medium, and we can't underestimate the importance of this.
Well, you're absolutely right, and it is the beauty of the podcast is the fact that it's around all the time. People can download it and listen to it. They can use it as a great marketing tool, and especially the information from the guests that we bring on every week, I feel is very, very important, or we wouldn't have them on, right?
That's right, and, you know, we'd be doing something else that's probably a lot less fun. So in any case, I just want to say I so appreciate you taking time out of your every single Saturday. You're so dedicated, and I so appreciate it. I don't know what I'd do if we didn't have this. So in any case, kudos to you, kudos to your company, and to all the people. I have to remind people, this show has been on the air every single Saturday evening, except for maybe one or two exceptions at the most, for the last 16 months, and I have to say that is a huge record. I don't know. So I'm very proud of that, and we're going to keep going as long as we can, and as long as we keep up the good quality. And, you know, that's the way I like to think about it. And tonight's guest is no different. Occasionally we have a repeat guest, and our guest here is a, I won't say repeat offender because she's a very good woman, but she is a repeat guest. This may be like the third time, and you're golden. Anna Baragazzi is our guest this evening from CONSACS, which stands for Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services. And Anna is the communication director and director of public policy at that agency, and it is a nonprofit in Connecticut, and they do wonderful work. And she is here to primarily talk about some updates and some legislation and maybe some other programs that we haven't touched upon. So, Anna, I just want to say thank you for taking time out on your Saturday evening to be with us again. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks so much for having me again. Hello.
Hi. We're very gratified to have you. And as we said many months ago, we're going to have you on again, so we made good on our promises, and isn't that good? I think before we get into the meat of the matter, in case there's anyone out there, Anna, I mean, everyone probably knows what a communication director is, and but maybe they're not too sure about what a public policy person does. And, you know, there are different realms. President Obama has his public policy person. I don't know if you can compare yourself to those people, but can you explain that briefly to our audience? What does a public policy person do, whether it's in a nonprofit or state government or federal government, et cetera?
Sure. So the idea of public policy or any kind of legislative advocacy is to really impact the systems that create laws within our society. So there are a lot of different ways to look at public policy. All of the things that we think of as laws, all of the, you know, you can't shoot somebody, you can't assault somebody, you know, all of these sort of criminal statutes, that's kind of one piece of what makes up public policy is the laws that are on the books federally and then from state to state. And then we also have pieces that kind of fall into this category of administrative policy where, you know, that's the paperwork that you fill out when you go to the DMV or, you know, how we have to fill out paperwork for, you know, insurance companies or for, you know, anything that we have to do kind of on our day-to-day basis. And there's a lot of opportunity to improve those systems, whether it's to improve the systems of laws that we have on the local, state, or federal level, or to improve the systems that govern our experience of kind of the day-to-day life, how we interact with the systems that we have in our society.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that I know you, a part of your job, you testify at the legislature with regard to things that are of special interest to your agency. You go out and you work with sexual assault rape victims. You educate people. Is that the full gamut of what you do? And maybe you want to mention a couple things about what other people do at your agency. I don't think we covered that previously.
Sure. So I'll back up a little bit and just talk about what CONSACS is. So Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services, where I work, is the coalition of the 9 community-based sexual assault crisis services programs throughout Connecticut. So those 9 programs are the programs that are really engaged in the direct advocacy on behalf of sexual assault survivors and their loved ones. So we have programs that cover every city and town all throughout the state of Connecticut. So those local programs and the advocates that work there are the folks that staff our 24/7 statewide hotline. We have 2 hotlines, one in English and one in Spanish. And I'll just kind of throw those numbers out there because I think it's really important to emphasize where people can go for services.
Mm-hmm.
But our 24-hour English hotline is 888-999-5545. And we also have a 24/7 Spanish hotline, and the number for that is 888-568-8332. So the advocates.
And this is in state, correct, Anna?
It is. We've been working on ways to accept out-of-state calls. So we do have a way, you know, if you're calling from a cell phone, like I know, even though I personally have been in Connecticut for almost 6 years, I still have an out-of-state cell phone. So we've been updating the hotline to be able to accept those phone calls as well. So we're making some progress there. But those nine programs staff that hotline. Those are the advocates that receive phone calls from police departments or from hospitals when they have a sexual assault survivor who could use information, support, counseling. You know, anytime a sexual assault survivor goes to the emergency room to have forensic evidence collected, those hospitals are supposed to call our advocates so they can show up at the hospital and be there to provide information, to provide support, and to help people who are in that moment of crisis understand what's going on.
Is that written in statute, and is that part of the Crime Victims Bill of Rights? Is that what you're referring to?
No. So this is kind of a good illustration of that divide between legislation and other forms of public policy advocacy.
Okay.
So that's not something that's written into law. That's not something that the state can necessarily enforce. But that's a piece of administrative policy, you know, where CONSACS or advocates can go to local hospitals or to the Connecticut Hospital Association and say, you know, as a matter of practice, something that we would like to see is for every hospital to make efforts to contact victim advocates because it really, you know, it helps their experience of evidence collection. So there are always a couple of different ways to go about doing things. You know, sometimes legislation is the most effective way to implement a change that you'd like to see, and sometimes it's just a matter of building relationships with hospitals or you know, the groups that work with hospitals in order to say, you know, your experience as healthcare providers is actually improved if you develop policies that allow victim advocates to be present.
And what has been your experience with regard to the hospitals in our state and their receptivity or ability to actually call advocates in when they should?
A lot of them do a good job. I mean, one of the issues is that we don't necessarily, we don't know what we don't know, so it's hard for us to know when we're not contacted by a hospital. You know, and there are some ways that we can sort of piece together that information. You know, if we see that a hospital, you know, is reporting that they've collected, you know, 100 evidence collection kits, but that local rape crisis program, you know, has only been called 5 times to come meet with survivors in the emergency department, you know, then we can look at that and say, like there seems to be a need for, you know, a better relationship here or a better policy to ensure that, you know, we're being called to be part of that response.
Okay.
So, you know, so we have those 9 programs that do the direct victim services advocacy. And then on the statewide level, CONTACTS sort of serves as an umbrella organization for those 9 programs. And what I mean by that is that we're able to be present on a statewide level where, you know, our local programs might be working with to build those relationships with individual hospitals. CONTACTS is working to develop a relationship with the Connecticut Hospital Association or with legislators, or we're working on more of those statewide level relationships that then kind of trickle down and impact the experiences at those local programs and of individual survivors.
I see. Okay. So that's another function.
Our office also does.
Do you have others you want to mention?
Sure. Our office also does grant management. So a lot of the funding that comes into Connecticut through state or federal sources, CONTACTS works to maintain those grants, to make sure we're doing correct reporting, to make sure that we're distributing that funding to the local programs. We also do training on a statewide level. So we have folks who work out of my office who do training at local police department, or not at the local police departments, but who train at the statewide police academy, and who work with colleges and universities to make sure that kind of on a bigger statewide level there's an understanding of how sexual violence works and how every system and individual in the state can be working to end it or improve the response to it.
So it sounds like you have a pretty big, even though we comparatively have a small, it's a small state demographically, you have a broad outreach.
We do. And one other piece of what the work that we do right out of the CONTACTS office that's exciting, and it's actually a national model at this point. Although a lot of our advocacy is concentrated in these 9, you know, or a lot of our direct victim services is out of these 9 local programs, CONTACTS also has, I think at this point we're up to 14 victim advocates who work in parole and probation units throughout the state. And these advocates work with survivors whose offenders are at a post-conviction stage. So these are advocates who are working with survivors usually several years after the assaults occurred to say, you know, hey, you have an offender who's coming out of prison soon. Here's information that you need to know about, you know, his terms of parole or probation. What do you need to feel safe in your community? You know, so they work with safety planning. They make sure that survivors understand if their offender has a court date coming up. And they are really integral parts of something called sex offender supervision units, which is usually a part of an offender's parole or probation, is that they need to check in with these units to make sure that they're doing what they need to do, that they are taking responsibility for their offense, and not engaging in behaviors that would contribute to recidivism.
Can I ask, would these be the same personnel that would oversee someone, like, for example, I'm not sure that I was able to share with you that the perpetrator of my dad's homicide came up for parole a couple of months ago. Would those same hearing officers be the same people that would be deciding these types of cases, or would it be totally different people?
So I think the parole board, and I'm actually not sure about this, but I think the parole board hears any kind of parole case.
Okay, so it could be the same cast the character, so to speak.
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
You know, but
I don't
the,
know if I like that, but you gave me your answer. Oh, okay, very, very good, very good. No. So there's a very broad outreach, as you just reiterated for us and gave us kind of a framework here. And so it's definitely not a desk job, it sounds like, for sure. No. And but, you know, Anna, I thought it very important last time that you came on, particularly because I have a background in disabilities and have had my own disability of spastic cerebral palsy, but luckily very functional and, it doesn't really impede what I do, or I just don't let it. Sometimes mind over matter. But with a particular case that was in the news nationally and very, very horrendous with regard to a woman that was, very much incapacitated and had multiple disabilities and ended up having a caretaker, the Fortin case, Richard Fortin case, who was a sexual offender, and I believe he was incarcerated for some period of time, but again, there was a Supreme Court ruling. And in case people did not have a chance to listen to that show or to read the background, would you be so kind as to start, because I know we have a few very interesting legislative things to talk about, as well as some programs that we want to get to. And so can you give a little background with regard to the Fortin case and then what you had to go through in order to bring this sort of up on the docket for the legislature to reconsider, to correct this awful wrong?
Sure. So the case of State v. Fortin goes back probably 3 or 4 years, or maybe even longer.
2009?
I think back to 2009. And the defendant in this case, Richard Fortin, was accused of sexually assaulting a woman who had very severe and limiting physical and developmental disabilities. So she was completely nonverbal, used a wheelchair, needed help with kind of all aspects of day-to-day living. This man, Richard Fortin, served as sort of in a caretaker capacity. I think he was the victim's mother's boyfriend. But he sexually assaulted her. The case went to trial. A jury convicted him of the crime. He went to jail and then appealed kind of on a technicality. He said, or his lawyers, I guess, said, you know, he was convicted, I think the charges were attempted sexual assault in the second degree and sexual assault in the fourth degree, both of which hinge on this idea of having a victim who is, quote, physically helpless. And up until this legislation that passed within the last couple of months, in Connecticut, physical helplessness was defined as being unconscious or for any other reason physically unable to communicate unwillingness to enact. And Mr. Fortin and
his... unconscious, and what was the other aspect again?
Or for any reason, physically unable to communicate unwillingness to enact.
So would that, in practical terms, Anna, would that mean somebody in a coma?
Well, sort of. That's ultimately what the court decided through the appeals process, is they looked at that definition, Fortin and his attorneys said, well, you know, this woman can't be considered physically helpless because, you know, even though she communicates with great difficulty, she has a very difficult time making herself understood, it's a slow communication process, you know, she wasn't unconscious at the time of the assault, and it's not fair to say that she was completely unable to communicate unwillingness. And part of what the appeals court and the Supreme Court cited in their decisions was that... I think it was the woman's mother in this case testified that, you know, if she sits down for breakfast and they give her a bowl of cereal that she doesn't like, she's capable of, like, knocking it over as a way to demonstrate a preference that she doesn't want that cereal. So the court said, well, that's a form of communication. And specifically, they said, you know, she's capable of biting, kicking, and scratching, all of which are ways to, you know, if somebody bites you or kicks you or scratches you, they're communicating a form of unwillingness. So the court said, you know, she was able to communicate, therefore she can't be considered physically helpless based on the statutory definition that we had in play. So basically what the court did was they said, there seems to be a loophole here in the law. And as advocates, we looked at that and said, well, that seems like a very unfair loophole that, you know, we have prosecutors who are relying on this definition of physical helplessness to protect individuals, such as the victim in the Fortin case, who have, you know, who just aren't able in all circumstances, especially when they're being confronted with a situation of violence, not able to effectively communicate their unwillingness, not just to anything. You know, there's a big difference between being able to knock over a bowl of cereal to say, I don't want to eat that cereal, and being able to tell someone who's trying to engage with you in sexual contact, you know, to be able to communicate, you know, I'm not interested in this particular form of sexual contact right now. That's a much more complicated sort of thought, and something that I don't think we can expect people to, you know, have to bite or kick or scratch somebody who is attempting to have sex with them. So we said, okay, well, this is something that needs to change. So we started working, I think, 4 legislative sessions ago to work on this definition of physical helplessness. And while we were at it, you know, we also started working with this great coalition of folks from the disability community. And we worked with the Connecticut Council on Developmental Disabilities, the ARC of Connecticut, the Office of Protection and Advocacy, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, you know, who said, well, as long as we're looking at these sexual assault statutes and this idea of physical helplessness, we should also pay attention to the fact that Connecticut's criminal statutes also talk about victims who are mentally defective.
Mentally defective.
So that word was still in statute, you know, as a way to refer to individuals who have mental disabilities. So we kind of made this into one big bill that said, okay, how do we, you know, rewrite just very small, you know, limited portions of these sexual assault statutes to get rid of that kind of offensive phrase, mentally defective, and to also ensure that the definition of physical helplessness is realistic and actually applies to people who have, you know, very limited and restrictive disabilities.
Right.
You know, while at the same time...
So what happened with that?
So we had a few... and, you know, looking back on it, you know, I always wish that, you know, when we identify some sort of injustice that we can correct it quickly. But looking back, you know, I'm glad we had time to really think about this issue because it is really complicated. And one of the complications we ran into early on is, you know, how do we redefine physically helpless in a way that protects people, you know, such as the victim in the Fortin case, who, you know, really didn't have an opportunity to effectively communicate, but to also protect the rights of people with disabilities who want to have consensual sex, because I think that's very important, too, that, you know, we weren't trying to say through this legislation that if you have a disability, you know, you have to be celibate for your entire life. That was never anybody's goal. But it
so how did you go about accomplishing that? Sometimes it may be like a fine line.
Yeah, so there was a lot of conversation about that, a lot of working with you know, people with disabilities and disability advocacy organizations to say, how do we characterize this in a way that's both effective and fair? So the definition that we finally settled on that ended up passing this year, the new definition is of physical helplessness, is a person who's unconscious or for any other reason physically unable to resist an act of sexual intercourse or sexual contact or to communicate unwillingness to an act of sexual intercourse or sexual contact. So we made it more specific. We said, you know, this isn't about being able to...
kick, bite, or scratch.
So this is, okay, you know, are you able to, you know, communicate something that's situationally appropriate? So, you know, do you understand that someone wants to have sex with you, and are you able to, you know, sort of articulate that, you know, okay, I'm okay with this?
Yay or nay. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and if someone's physically unable to resist or communicate, such as the victim in the Fortin case, you know, then that's the standard that we're looking at. And the victim in that particular case is actually a good example of kind of the nuance that we are trying to get at, because she's someone who, you know, in that situation wasn't able to resist her aggressor. But if he had, you know, taken the time, she's able to communicate, you know, very slowly and carefully through a communication board. But in that case, if he had gone and gotten her communication board and said, you know, what are you comfortable, you know, point to the parts of your body that you're okay with me touching. You know, if he had taken those steps and allowed her the opportunity to, you know, communicate what she was willing to do.
I just can't imagine that, because here's this man who was in a relationship with the mother. I mean, Anna, that's bringing this out to the nth degree, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, kind of bending over backwards.
Well, but at the same time, you know, we do want to make sure that
I know what you're saying.
Yeah, that if she had wanted that sexual contact,
right.
You know, she would have had a way to communicate willingness, but since she.
Right.
And she wasn't given that opportunity, and since she was physically unable to resist that act, you know,
so
I think.
Bottom line, what would you say now? For now the law is clearer, and it wouldn't be going to the state Supreme Court, because it's a lot more clarified with respect to what the law says, and any situations in the future, this could not happen in that same way. Isn't that right?
That's what we're hopeful of. You know, now we have some good legislative intent established. You know, as legislators were debating this, you know, they were very careful to kind of talk through some of these scenarios on the House and Senate floor.
Right.
You know, so the courts now have that on record to be able to say, okay, this is what legislators were looking at. This is the kind of case and the kind of issue that they're hoping to avoid moving forward. So I think
yeah.
I think we're in much better shape moving forward.
And my last question on this law is, was this nationally a precedent-setting case? So they're going to be looking at this in other states if this were to occur in, you know, California, Missouri, Nebraska, wherever it is?
You know, we'll see. I think we have language that could be a model. Our previous statutory language, that physical helplessness definition,
was archaic.
It dated back to it was based on the Model Penal Code, which a lot of states adopted back in the 50s and 60s.
Okay.
So, yeah, mm-hmm. We haven't really revised that language, and a lot of other states have very similar language on the books. And, you know, occasionally you'll see a case that really runs into problems. And the Fortin case isn't the only case that's come up in Connecticut where we've seen these problems. There was another case probably at least 15 or 20 years ago, where a woman had somehow been injured or was sick and was being transported to a hospital in the back of an ambulance. And one of the EMTs strapped her down on the, it's not a gurney,
stretcher.
But whatever, the stretcher, strapped her down on the stretcher and sexually assaulted her. And he was charged with, you know, under this same statute as sexually assaulting a woman who was physically helpless because she was stretched, you know, tied down.
Mm-hmm.
And the appeals court at the time said, you know, well, she wasn't physically helpless because she was wide awake and she was actively saying no. So you can't say she was unable to communicate because she was communicating the whole time.
Which is just awful. I just have had my fill of this injustice. It just makes my blood boil. So let's hope that going forward, things will change for the better. I know that the disability community maybe can sleep a little better. I don't know. Can we go over now? You know, we've got 30 minutes left of our show to discuss some of our other things here. We've got Maybe a couple of other bills we might want to mention, and I do want to talk about a couple of very innovative programs. Because we work so closely with Intimate Partner on violence and homicide, domestic violence, can you tell us about an act concerning the domestic violence and sexual assault, and what were some of the changes with regard to that, some inroads that you made this year?
Sure. So House Bill 6702, an act concerning domestic violence and sexual assault, was a pretty big bill that made a handful of changes to how our state is going to handle sexual assault and domestic violence cases moving forward. A lot of the changes were just sort of technical changes. In a lot of a lot of Connecticut statutes still referred to battered women. So it would say, you know, if a victim seeks services at a battered women's program. Some semantic changes. So battered women was changed to domestic violence to capture the idea that men can also be victims of domestic violence, and also to really reflect the language of the movement. There were some changes to language around possession of firearms, that there are certain crimes you can commit that revoke your ability to own own certain weapons. In statute before, it had just said, you know, if you've been convicted of a felony or if you used a weapon, like in a domestic violence crime, you couldn't own a pistol or revolver. So this bill expanded it to be pistols, revolvers, or all firearms. So
machine guns, anything, right?
Right, right.
Restraining orders too, right? There was a change there, and leases.
Right. So there are two changes that are particular to sexual assault survivors that we're really excited about. One change creates a task force to study the issue of how to provide restraining orders to victims of sexual violence. Right now, sexual assault survivors are only eligible for restraining orders if they were assaulted by a family or household member. So somebody that they're currently or have been in a relationship with, which excludes probably 40% or so of sexual assault victims, don't have any sort of prior, dating or family relationship with their offenders.
What do you mean when we have to, I just hate this about government, and I think Delilah, why do we have to study it? We know it's occurring already. Why can't we just, do it?
Well, so the study piece is around how to do it. We had thought there was originally a bill this year that said, sexual assault victims would be able to receive these restraining orders in the same way that domestic violence victims get restraining orders. That seemed pretty easy and straightforward. But the family court said, whoa, we just don't have the staff or the resources, or the ability to handle this influx of sexual assault survivors who would be applying for these restraining orders. So the idea is to take a year to figure out, which part of the judicial branch is best equipped to, to develop and hand out these restraining orders. So hopefully this means that, next legislative session we'll be able to pass a specific plan to make that happen.
Can I ask, Delilah, to your knowledge, do you know with regard to sexual assault victims in other states, whether it be your state or where Susan was from or whatever, is that the same? Is it kind of across the board that they would be doing that as a matter of course, or is our state kind of behind with that, in your opinion?
I honestly don't know. I have no idea. I don't know what the statutes or laws are in other states concerning that.
Sexual assault and the restraining orders?
I'm not sure. I really couldn't comment.
I should clarify a little bit. In Connecticut, sexual assault survivors, regardless of who their offender is, are eligible for criminal restraining orders. So if there's been an arrest in your case, you can go and get the order. This is specifically about civil restraining orders. So because we know that so many sexual assault cases, there never is an arrest. You can say, my neighbor sexually assaulted me. I can identify the person. But, the police might not, pursue the case, or there's not enough evidence, or the prosecutor, you know, doesn't, the case just never gets to the point of arrest. As of, I haven't updated my research in the last couple of months, but there are at least 17 states that offer these civil restraining orders where you don't need to have an arrest, where you can just go to the court and say, you know, I was sexually assaulted, you know, yesterday by my neighbor. I'm really scared. You know, give me one of these, one of these restraining orders. So it's something that, you know, more and more states are looking at.
Are you having to go in with proof, like something from the emergency room or a test kit or something, or do they take your word for it?
That's something that we'll need to. I'm not sure how it plays out in all other states, but that's something that I think will need to be part of the conversation as we look at how we want those orders to work in Connecticut.
Okay.
So we'll. It's one of those pieces to figure out.
And then the one other benefit there, and I don't think we have to spend a lot of time on it, is that they're able to break a lease following a sexual assault. Is that right? Before you couldn't break a lease?
Right. So there was a law for domestic violence survivors that passed, I think, 2 years ago that said if you are a victim of domestic violence, you're able to break a lease without penalty. If you feel at risk remaining in your apartment. And we looked at that and said, wow, like that could be really helpful for sexual assault survivors as well, because we've heard of cases where, you know, the offender is the landlord or the neighbor or someone who, can continue to threaten or intimidate the victim just by their proximity. So now, you know, and the idea of having to pay huge penalties to break a lease is such a barrier that we were hearing about families who, you know, who were terrified and felt like they really had to choose sort of between financial ruin and safety. And that's not a decision that
we want. It only makes sense, Anna. I mean, it's a very practical thing. So
I think
I'm glad you did that.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of segue over to some of the prevention aspects. I know one particular program that we wanted to talk about was CONSACS and Men Can Stop Rape. What's that about?
Sure. So one of the really exciting campaigns that CONSACS is working on right now is with this organization. They're based in D.C. They're this really fantastic national organization called Men Can Stop Rape. And we're working with them on this campaign called Where You Stand Connecticut. And the campaign focuses on engaging Connecticut men in being active in preventing sexual violence in their communities. The whole idea of Men Can Stop Rape is that we have this great anti-sexual violence movement that for years has been very focused on women, on responding to the violence that's perpetrated against women, on making sure that women who are victims of violence feel supported and that their needs are being met. But this idea that Men Can Stop Rape is promoting, and that, you know, CONSACS really believes in as well, is that if we want to talk about actually ending sexual violence, having no new victims, we need to make sure that men are part of the conversation. Because, you know, for the most part, you know, we do know that many men are victims of sexual violence and some women are perpetrators of sexual violence. But for the most part, it's upwards of 97% of sexual violence is perpetrated by men. So if they're not part of the conversation, how can we ever expect to? Right. They have to be invested in ending this sort of violence.
What does that mean in practical terms for the men that are participating?
There are a few ideas, and what this Where Do You Stand campaign focuses on is this idea that, even though there's a very, very small population of men who commit violence, most men don't want violence. Most men don't want to see anyone raped or assaulted or hurt. And what we're trying to do is engage those men, the ones who don't want violence, to be active bystanders, to be out in their community. And when they see that small percentage of men who are, engaging in predatory behaviors, we want kind of the good men out there to feel empowered to say, hey, you know, I don't think you should be doing that right now.
Do you mean in public places, like if you're in a restaurant or a bar or something, then they're gonna be there to kind of set the example or stop something from happening?
Yeah, so there are actually a wide variety of techniques that men can use to interrupt this pattern of violence. So, you know, that idea of being in a bar is perfect. That, you know, if you're out with friends and one of your friends is saying, oh, hey, like that girl over there, she's falling off the bar stool, she's so drunk, I bet I can get her to go home with me. So there's one form of intervention where, you know, that man's friends could step up and say, you know, that's a bad idea. Actually, what you're describing is rape, and that's not appropriate, and we're not going to let you do that, and we're going to call that woman a cab and make sure she gets home safely. You know, so there's that really active intervention.
Mm-hmm. It's another way.
So there's also, you know, men who are engaging in, you know, violent speech or, you know, even that situation at the bar. If a man's not appropriate, you know, doesn't feel comfortable saying, you know, no, I'm stepping up, I'm not letting you talk to her, we're calling her. You know, if they don't feel comfortable doing that, you know, is it also possible for him to recognize the situation and say, oh, you know, don't approach her, you know, I think we're all tired and we need to go home. You know, so there are little, you know, sort of less assertive ways that men can be involved as well. Or, you know, even before you're at a moment where someone's actively talking about perpetrating a crime, you know, but maybe, you know, they're in the locker room and they're saying, oh, man, well, this weekend I think we need to have a party with a lot of beer and wouldn't it be really cool if, you know, to say, actually, no, like there are other ways that we can have fun, or, you know, that's not a respectful way to talk about women. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this campaign focuses, you know, on some of that active intervention, but also on changing the culture that surrounds sexual violence.
What have you seen with regard to, and if this, obviously it's national, it's been effective in other places, and it's a matter of maybe a learning curve here, men's willingness or unwillingness to get involved, to do, whether it's subtle or active intervention like that, I feel like, you know, oh God, I don't want to get involved in that kind of thing. I mean, how do you change the, you know, macho men attitude, especially if there's alcohol or drugs involved?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, sort of the the uphill battle. I mean, we know, you know, that even anecdotally, that most men want to live in a world that's safe, where people aren't being hurt, where people aren't being, you know, injured and assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
Most men really want that for their own lives, for the people they love, and for their communities. But, you know, because we sort of glorify this culture where, you know, men are very aggressive, like from a very young age, we teach men to express their masculinity in ways
right.
that are very aggressive, very sexual, very violent. And I think in a lot of ways that's very difficult for men, and it's very sad for men that we tell them, you know, in order to be, I mean, so there's just all these kind of complicating factors, right, that, like, if you think of, you know, middle school, like the worst insult you can throw at a teenage boy is, you know, oh, you're such a sissy, you're such a girl, you're such a baby. You know, we really feminize boys as a way to insult them.
Terminology like that,
you know, so what we need to be saying is, you know what, like, we can create a better version of masculinity where being masculine it's not only about, you know, throwing a football or, you know, being tough and having big muscles and fighting people. Like, being a man can be about being compassionate and, you know, being somebody who stands up for your friends and being somebody who's loyal and honest. And, you know, we can reimagine masculinity in a way that's positive and in a way that allows men to hold each other accountable for some of these actions that, again, most men don't really want to see in their community.
Yeah. Delilah, what do you think of this? Do you think this is possible in our culture? I mean, you deal with people all across the country. I'm just wondering what you think about this movement.
Well, I totally agree with everything that Anna has been talking about, and it's a culture of violence, and it's the cycle of violence, and I think any way that we can get to the root of it, which in my opinion starts within the family circle, and how to find ways to change the culture, to change the way people think about other people and not violently. We have to teach them very, very, I think, very young, teach even children ways to stop that cycle, ways to deal with the violence when they see it happening in their homes. How can they react to it? Because it's just going to continue to repeat and repeat and repeat if we can't find some way to change the cultural thinking about violence. We glorify it. We glorify it in television, movies, music. I mean, violence is glorified to children. And
yeah,
level. I mean, I think all of the organizations that deal with adults are more than important. However, I think if we go back down to the root of it and start working with our children in some way, whether through the schools or through other organizations, reading programs, communities have to come together and start saving these kids so that they don't grow up to perpetuate everything that we're talking about today.
Yeah, I so agree with you. It starts there at a very young age. And Anna, that kind of leads us naturally to a progression of another area that we wanted to talk about, and is pretty pervasive, and it's been topical in the national news, and that's with regard to sexual violence, both men and women, in the military. What's that about, and what can you tell us that's happening on all levels?
Sure. So there's been a lot of attention in the media, and in the in federal legislative circles recently about sexual violence in the military, which has really reached sort of epidemic rates. The Department of Defense estimates that, last year in 2012, that there were approximately 26,000 incidences of sexual violence among service members.
Wow. And that's everything, men on women, women on men, men on men, women on women. I mean, it includes the gamut?
Correct. So what we see, if you look at the raw numbers, the estimates are that more men than women are sexually assaulted within the military. I mean, in part because the majority of the military population is male. But percentage-wise, female soldiers are more at risk of being raped by a fellow soldier than they are of being injured or killed by an enemy combatant. So, I mean, we ask so much and require so much sacrifice of our service members that, to then put them in a situation for female soldiers in particular where their greatest fear isn't necessarily being hurt by, someone else. It's about being injured kind of within your own ranks. So one of the big issues that's been identified, there are a lot of, ideas and discussions about why rates of sexual violence in the military are so high. And a lot of that discussion does focus on this idea of kind of hyper-masculine culture and, what's it like when we sort of train people to go out and fight and to be aggressive and to, really make that something that's valued in this particular culture. So there's sort of that piece of it, but then there's also this piece of, does the way that the military respond to sexual violence end up perpetuating it? And I think that's a real possibility that, even though, the estimates for last year is that, there were 26,000 sexual assaults in the military, but only 3,374 of those assaults were reported. So that's about a 13% reporting rate. And we know that sexual violence, it's just so low. And, we have pretty severe underreporting in civilian populations as well. Right around 50%+ of sexual assaults go unreported in the civilian world. But 13% is just so sort of abysmally low.
Are they just saying, well, this is part of the culture, this is something we have to put up with, I just almost got, killed by a bomb, and it's okay for me to go in and, rape this person? I mean, I don't know. I can't make that leap that, 13%, that's very low.
Yeah, so I think service members face a lot of really intense barriers to reporting.
It's a culture, isn't it? The military culture.
The culture is really important. You know, a lot of military survivors have described their experience of military sexual violence in ways that are very similar to incest. That, you know, your fellow service members really are your family in a lot of ways. That, you know, these are the people who you're literally trusting your life to every day to keep you safe and to make, you know, to keep you safe, to keep your country safe. So, you know, and they use that language of family a lot within the military as well. So it feels like a big betrayal to some service members to report against another soldier who's assaulted them. You know, so there's that piece. There's also the piece of, you know, the military is so much more than just a job to people. I mean, it's a job, it's a lifestyle, it's housing, it's salary. It's, you know, people give up so much to be part of the military. And you do risk a lot currently by disclosing that, you know, they might not, you know, promote you if you disclose a sexual assault. They might, you know, if you seek, you know, mental health treatment because of a sexual assault, that can impact your ability to get certain security clearances later on. And, you know, one of the one of the big barriers is that currently anyone who wants to disclose a sexual assault has to disclose to a commanding officer within their unit. And I apologize to anybody who from the military who's listening. I'm sure I'm getting some of my military vocabulary wrong, but you know, these disclosures need to be made to someone within the chain of command, which is especially difficult if one of your commanding officers is the person who is sexually assaulting you, you know, or if your commanding officer says, you know, well, but I really like that guy, you know, who's working with me, who you're saying assaulted you, like. I don't believe you, so I'm not going to report this up the chain of command. So these commanding officers.
So wouldn't you just go up the chain of command yourself if you know that, you know, that's the offender? Then you go higher than that person, just like if there's some other incident in the workplace, you go above that person?
That's just not how the military works. That, I mean, it's a culture that is very reliant on protocol, and there are very particular ways to do things. So, you know, if they say you report to your commanding officer, there's no way for you to not do that. Like, the system just doesn't have the ability for variance. That's something that federally, there's legislation right now that's trying to change that. Senator Gillibrand from New York had a bill called the Military Justice Improvement Act that would have taken reporting outside of the chain of command. And the Senate Armed Services Committee, you know, dropped that that act from the bigger National Defense Authorization Act. But she's gathering co-sponsors, and she plans to reintroduce that act, that concept, as an amendment when the full Senate looks at the defense authorization.
Do you think that has a trickle-down effect to and I think it's so underreported too, the number of suicides in the military? So if this is occurring, you know, so often, and only 13%, you know, are reporting, and you can't report to your commanding officer for whatever reason, well, I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. And, you know, this is hard enough as it is. I'm going to take myself out or whatever. I mean, is there a relationship there?
Yeah, so this idea of military sexual trauma, you know, studies are showing that this is one of the leading causes of post-traumatic stress disorder among female veterans. And there's a really powerful documentary that, you know, anybody who's interested in this issue that I would 100% recommend called The Invisible
Really
War. That goes through and interviews survivors of military sexual violence. And, you know, one of the survivors who's interviewed just has this really powerful story about what it's like to be in that place, to have experienced sexual violence in the military, and just, you know, how that was so tied into, for her, feelings of suicide as well. I mean, it's just a really just powerful documentary that, you know, captures.
Do you have the reference for that, Anna?
The Invisible War, I don't know if you can, like, get it on Netflix, but they have a great website. If you go online and just look up The Invisible War, you can get information about...
The Invisible War?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So it was a documentary done on network TV, or...?
I think it was just an independent film. It was nominated for an Oscar this year. We've done a couple screenings of it around Connecticut.
Really? Okay, I'll look it up and put it in the blog. How about that?
Great. Yeah, it's a really good film.
That sounds wonderful. Well, you know, it sounds like this is something that really needs to be addressed and part and parcel of the whole cause of the PTSD and suicide and, you know, the whole thing. It's all you know, interrelated. And I think anything that we can do to, like you said, change the protocol, change the culture, you know, get men who are, and women who are not offending to step up and be counted and defend other people and not be afraid to do that with the consequences it's what you have to do, and it's the only way we're going to change. And I think Delilah's point is so on target with respect to starting kids early, and, you know, limiting their exposure to all this violence and stuff, and teaching them respect in so many ways. And but, you know, we just have like 3 minutes or so left, so I wanted to know, with regard to us winding up and then a couple of party comments, what is it that you would want to tell our national audience, Anna, with regard to the topics that we talked about today, or what is most in the forefront of your mind with respect to what's going on and the changes with what you do? What message should we carry? What should we try to do individually?
I really think that what we talked about regarding, you know, the primary prevention, the stopping sexual violence before it occurs, and how all of us need to feel empowered to own this issue and to not sort of put it off and to say, well, you know, nobody I know would ever consider, you know, committing sexual violence, or, you know, we have this tendency to make ourselves feel safe by insisting that the victimization isn't our issue. That, you know, I'm somebody who makes good choices, so I don't have to worry about this happening to me or happening to somebody who I care about. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that any of us can be impacted by, you know, any form of victimization. And, you know, because victimization has such this broad reach, we also really need to be invested in preventing it. That we all have a role in creating a culture that doesn't tolerate violence and that gives people better options for how to behave.
Yeah. Is that a sense where you, I know that you're working with this organization from out of Washington, but do you partner with the other contacts, for lack of a better word, within New England and across the country? Is there a coalition that you're all working together?
We stay in very good touch with other sexual assault coalitions and organizations that are committed to doing this work. Because at the end of the day, you know, there are so many different ways to do this work and to do this work well. You know, there are organizations that are very focused on helping survivors share their voice, and that's really important to the work of ending sexual violence. And some organizations are very focused on engaging men, which is another important piece of ending sexual violence. You know, some groups are very focused on law enforcement. There's so many pieces and so many, you know, almost any interest that you have, there's a way to kind of bottle that knowledge and that enthusiasm and use it to become an advocate and to help end sexual violence.
Okay, very good. Well, you know, unfortunately, we're going to have to kind of wind it up here. I want to thank you so much for the information you imparted, and it's very useful, and we'll be sure to write it up. I want to thank Delilah for being our co-host and our producer, and please remember to go to my website, www.donnagore.com, to the Shattered Lives site, and please do invite your friends so we can get as many people over there watching it. And be sure to stay tuned for another episode next Saturday. And I'll be in touch with you, Anna and Delilah. Thank you, everyone, and have a good evening, okay? Good night.